WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the homeless tunnel dwellers of New York City. We talk with photographer Margaret Morton about documenting the community of people who have lived in a train tunnel under Manhattan's Upper West Side. Morton's photographs are collected in a new book, and we'll talk with an 8-year resident of the tunnel who moved out last week. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how the meaning of the suburbs has changed. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, Bob Kalinske moved out of a New York City train tunnel where he had lived underground with other homeless people for close to 8 years. We'll meet him in a few minutes. My first guest, Margaret Morton, documents that homeless community in her new book, The Tunnel. It's part of her larger photographic study of homeless communities that have sprung up in New York City. The tunnel stretches 2.5 miles from 72nd Street to 123rd Street under Manhattan's Upper West Side. The train line that ran through it was discontinued in the mid-70s, and homeless people started moving in. A community of about 50 people was discovered by Amtrak in 1991 when crews were laying new tracks for a passenger line. Amtrak got most of the people to move, but the community eventually grew back to its former size. Amtrak police sealed off tunnel entrances last summer. Now, with the help of homeless advocates and an obscure federal voucher program, the tunnel people are relocating. Margaret Morton learned about the tunnel in the late 80s from other homeless people she was photographing. Her guide to the tunnel, Bernard, has lived there since 1985 and plans to move out next week. She told me about her first descent into the tunnel.
The very first time I visited the tunnel, it was a bright, sunny day, and I descended the stairs. And at the time, several of the stairs were missing, and Bernard would call out at key moments to watch out for the missing stair rung. And it was pitch black, and it happens very quickly. You start down the stairs, and all of a sudden, just everything goes black, and you really can't see. And I didn't think to bring a flashlight, and so suddenly I'm in this totally black world, and it's very cold and very damp. And there's a very damp smell to the tunnel. And the blackness is very, very thick. It's an impenetrable blackness. It was unlike anything I'd ever experienced before.
You were going into the tunnel to document how people lived there. How did people live there? Did they create little homes for themselves underground?
It was quite amazing to me when I spent time in the tunnel, got to know the tunnel better, that there are very many different types of housing in the tunnel. People do create living spaces for themselves. Some of them are quite elaborate, but they range. Some people live in concrete structures that are existing, that were built in the 1930s when the railroad was built. Other people have built plywood shanties alongside the tracks. Other people live up these ladders that go up the walls of the tunnel about 25 feet and are these small alcoves or niches, and they've built homes in those. And then other people just live up in these little dark recesses of the tunnel. It's a very large tunnel, and there are many, many different types of alcoves and places. It's not at all like a subway tunnel where you just have a narrow space along the tracks. There are actually large places in this tunnel where there's just rock and dirt and kind of mounds of earth, and people can live up in those also.
What are some of the things that the people living in the tunnel did to make their little spaces seem more homey? Did people decorate them?
Yes, people decorate their homes. They have furniture. They really aren't very different than a small apartment would be in the sense that there would be a bed, a dresser, a table, often a desk and a chair. There might be a mirror. There would be a cupboard with dishes in it, a place to hang clothing. It was quite surprising how domestic it really was.
What about light?
Light comes through air vents, and that's one of the amazing things about the tunnel, because there are these shafts of light that angle through air vents, and it's really quite an extraordinary spectacle to see. It's something that one might experience in a great cathedral, to have this strong beam of light or beams of light coming down 25 feet and lighting the area. But the light just punctuates the blackness. It's only at intervals, and there are large stretches of the tunnel that are always in total blackness, no matter how bright of the day it is.
Did the people living down there use a lot of flashlights or kerosene lamps, or just get adjusted to the dark?
The people that live down there are very adjusted to the darkness. I always take flashlights, and I find that nobody else seems to need one. They can just walk through this total blackness and know everything underfoot, and often yell out to me that it's time to step aside. There's a hole in front of me, and always warning me about places to watch out for, places I might trip. And they just know the terrain. They can't really see it either, but they know the terrain so well that they know where there are various places that might be dangerous.
One of your pictures is of a man who brought a lot of stray animals down into the tunnel with him. And he collected cats and I think some dogs as well.
Yes, that was John. John lived in the tunnel about 23 years, and he had 15 cats and 3 dogs.
It must have been really hard to take care of them in the tunnel, and expensive to get food for them.
It is expensive to care for a pet as well as oneself, particularly when you have no source of income. But it's been my experience with the tunnel residents that they'll make sure their pets are fed before they're fed. And what's really amazing to me is how well cared for the pets really are. The people that live in the tunnel find that it's important to have a pet. It does give one something to take care of, and it also gives something back. And it's been interesting to me when I photograph people who have rejected the shelter system and rejected the system in general and have created housing for themselves, because I realize that so often they can't have pets and they can't have that type of companionship a pet would offer. And so by hiding away in an underground tunnel, they can actually have a situation that is more similar to what someone might have living in an apartment.
You've documented homeless people living in all kinds of situations in New York City. How would you compare life in the tunnel to the other homes that homeless people made for themselves in the city?
There are many different types of housing that can be created in the tunnel, unlike above ground, where people usually just have a plywood house or perhaps a tent. In the tunnel, one can build a house up against a concrete wall or column. They could find a place up in one of these hidden alcoves. They could live in one of the existing concrete structures. There are many different possibilities, and what has been interesting to me is that people explore all of them. There are very many different types of housing, and communities are formed in some parts of the tunnel, and then in other parts people live very much by themselves.
You must have asked everybody who you met in the tunnel why they chose to live there. What were some of the answers that you got?
The responses were quite interesting, but most people mentioned that they had a sense of freedom there that they didn't have in homeless communities, or certainly in the shelter, which all of these people have rejected. And they had the freedom to come and go as they pleased. They were left alone. They weren't bothering anyone. They weren't in sight of someone who wanted them to be removed. They lived in this totally isolated environment.
It must have been a lot of health problems for the people who are living down there. I mean, the air isn't very good. Probably a lot of rats and other vermin.
There are a lot of rats, particularly at the south end of the tunnel. It's quite overrun with rats. I haven't seen it pose a direct health problem, but there are a lot of respiratory problems in the tunnel. there's a lot of dust, and it's also very damp. So people do get bronchitis, and several people have asthma.
Did you feel safe as a woman when you were in the tunnel?
Well, I was much safer in the tunnel than people might think, because I got to know the people that lived there. And it's not safe every minute, but I really would always try to form bonds and friendships with people that were living there, so that even though I might go alone into the tunnel, once I got there, I wasn't by myself. I have walked through by myself, and a couple of times I've had experiences that were a bit frightening, but on the whole, I felt completely safe.
What was one of the frightening experiences?
Well, there was someone living in the tunnel that was mentally ill and quite paranoid, and they jumped up at me with a fire poker once, and I was quite taken aback by it because I'd walked by them when I was by myself several times before, and there'd never been any problem. And then after that, I mentioned it to several people that lived in the tunnel, and they told me that that's happened to them too, that if you come upon this person and they're in a particular state of mind, they can react that way.
So what'd you do?
Well, for a while after that, I made sure I always had somebody with me when I walked by him. And then just last week, I walked by and he said, "Is that Margaret?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "I'm really sorry about what happened."
My guest is photographer Margaret Morton. She's been documenting homeless communities in New York City since the late 80s. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Margaret Morton. Her new book, The Tunnel, documents a homeless community underground in a Manhattan train tunnel. Margaret, how did you take photographs in an underground tunnel that had so little light in it?
Well, it's difficult. I really have to use flashlights to see what I'm doing, and I do very long time exposures. I take my tripod and set it up on the tracks or alongside the tracks. It has been the most challenging photographic experience I've ever had.
Were there things that you wanted to photograph that you just couldn't get onto film?
One of the things that is difficult to photograph are the really dark recesses of the tunnel, places that you can see with your flashlight and are revealed by that type of light. And so to reveal them with the camera, one has to use a flash. And prior to the tunnel project, I was always committed to using existing light, and I realized that I couldn't continue that and document everything I wanted to document in the tunnel.
So you used a flash?
I did inside people's houses. It was really amazing to me when I would develop the film and make the photographs, and there'd be all these things in the photograph. There'd be all these decorations and furniture and usually three or four more cats that I hadn't seen when I actually printed the photograph. So I became very intrigued by the notion that the flash can reveal things that you can never see yourself. And the flash can probe into these dark corners of a room and the tunnel and reveal things to you.
After Amtrak workers discovered the homeless people living underground in this tunnel, the homeless people were issued an ultimatum that either they had to get out or they'd be arrested for trespassing. And what's the status of the people who lived there while you were doing your photographic study?
Well, actually, it's more complicated even than that, because when Amtrak discovered the people in 1991, they tried to move them out then, but the people in the tunnel refused to leave, and so Amtrak left the people there. And then just this past summer, there has been a lot of pressure for people to move out of the tunnel, and people were told they were trespassing, and the entrances have been sealed off except for the north and the south end. And when I found out about this increased pressure from Amtrak, I became very concerned because the other homeless communities that I photographed have always ended with bulldozers coming in and ravaging the community and then people being left fleeing with what possessions they could find from their homes right before they were destroyed and ending up sleeping in cardboard boxes and living in doorways. And I just didn't want to see this happen again. And I called Coalition for the Homeless and spoke with Mary Brosnahan, the director, and she came down into the tunnel with me and talked to the people about what was happening. And she looked into a program that had actually been initiated in November 1994, a federal program through the Department of Housing and Urban Planning that provided housing certificates for homeless people who were living in underground subway tunnels. And she investigated what had happened with this program and found out that only two of the 250 vouchers had been used in all this time that had passed from November 94 to June 95. And so she requested that these certificates also apply to this train tunnel. And as a result of this, four people have actually moved into apartments, and eight people have found apartments and are awaiting the paperwork so they can actually sign their leases and move in, which will happen in the next week to 10 days. And about seven have the certificates and are now looking for apartments. And there are about six to eight people with their paperwork still in progress. That still leaves quite a few people in the tunnel, but these people will be putting in their applications for paperwork as the other people move out.
In this particular homeless community, the people living in the tunnel, it looks like many of them will be relocated to actual homes, above-ground homes, with the help of these certificates. However, a lot of the homeless communities that you've documented have been destroyed because of public pressure to get the homeless people out of the neighborhood. Do you have a sense of futility? I mean, have you seen a lot of homeless communities just destroyed and then the homeless people move someplace else and set up another homeless community and then are pushed out of that one? In other words, are you seeing this just kind of like migrant population of homeless people where the homeless problem isn't solved? People just like move from one place to another.
Absolutely. One of the homeless people that I began photographing in 1991 in Tompkins Square Park, then moved to a vacant lot, and then he moved to a pedestrian underpass under the FDR Drive, and then he moved to a vacant lot, then he moved to a van, then he moved to an abandoned building, and he still resides there. And I would say that's the more typical result of clearing the homeless encampments. This is a very unique situation, and unfortunately there are no plans to continue this program. It was a pilot program.
The voucher program.
Right.
My guest is Margaret Morton, and her new book is called The Tunnel, and it's a book of photographs and essays about a community of homeless people living underground in a New York City tunnel. Margaret, you've brought with you one of the men who has lived in this tunnel. His name is Robert Kalinske. And I was wondering if you could introduce him for us.
I first met Bob in March 1991 on my first visit to the tunnel, and since then I've photographed him there. He's one of the very long-term residents of the tunnel, and he's very much a part of the book and has always supplied me with a lot of information just about homeless issues in general. There's more to being homeless than living in the tunnel. Other aspects of homeless life are certainly how one gets food, how one gets water and wood, and how one makes money. And Bob has always really given me kind of an overview of just surviving on the street.
Well, Margaret, thanks for that introduction. And Bob Kalinske, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
When did you first move to the tunnel, and why did you move down there?
Well, I moved to the tunnel back in 1988. I met this fellow named Bernard Isaac, and we were cooking together at a soup kitchen. And he told me, he says, he knew I had problems, you know, at the place I was living in. He said, if you ever need a place, he told me where he lived. And he says, you know, you're welcome to come down. Well, 6 months later, needless to say, it was wintertime, snowing out. I didn't know where I was going. And I did the same thing. I came through the grate where Margaret went and yelled out his name, Bernard. And he came down, met me. He said, I told myself, I needed a place. And I stayed with him that night. And the next day, I moved into, I have the biggest house there. Mine was all brick. And he told me, he says, you know, this is yours. And I've been there ever since, except for taking a little time out.
You still living there now?
No, I moved out last week. Through the Project Renewal and this voucher program, I moved into a place called the Holland House, which is in Manhattan. It's just what I needed. You know, it's my own little space, and I pay a certain amount of rent, and my SSI takes care of the rest.
We'll talk about that more a little bit later. What were your very first impressions of the tunnel?
Well, I didn't know what to expect. I thought it would be a race problem because there were 8 black, 2 Hispanic, and I was the only white person. But Bernard wouldn't let that happen, and there wasn't. It was just like the hardest thing to do, or for me, the easiest thing to do was to adjust that I did live in the tunnel. See, a lot of people live in a homeless situation, and they try to really mentally think that they live someplace else. Accepting where you are at a precise time can help you in the long run.
So you accepted that you were living in the tunnel?
Of course, yeah. I knew I had given up everything I had. I was a cook and everything. I retired from being a cook. It's just that I had a heavy drug habit, and then I stopped, and I've been straight now. I just celebrated 10 years.
So is that how you ended up homeless, because of your drug habit?
Well, it's just that I gave up my wife, my kids, everybody else, you know. I wasn't taking care of my apartment. I had a beautiful apartment right by Lincoln Center, and everything just, you know, mentally I couldn't deal with it.
So tell me, when you first got to the tunnel, what it looked like, what it smelled like to you?
It was scary, because that's before they had the tracks, and there were a lot of holes, a lot of ditches.
What do you mean before they had the tracks?
I moved in before the Amtrak put the tracks in.
Oh.
It was all dirt and hills and everything. They took the tracks out. So then they put a whole new set of tracks in, and it was just like really dark. And it's 4 blocks underground you walk in the dark till you get to our space.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that time there were, you didn't know who outside people could come in. Now it's all been closed off. But you didn't know if there were any muggers down there. I've never been mugged. But there were kids that hung out down there, gangs that hung out down there, all various people. And you just had to walk, and just like, you know, you can't show them you're scared. But now it's like all closed up. It was like a lot safer.
Did you ever get into fights down there?
No. I've never had a fight in the tunnel in the 8 years, in the time I was there.
Is there some kind of code down there?
We don't have violence. We don't allow violence. We don't allow drinking. There were certain things you had to do to exist down there. You had to have your wood. You had to have your water.
Wood for the fire?
Right. And you had to have the food. And I did recycling cans. I worked for We Can, which is an organization that helped homeless people. And I went out and got my cans. I was up roughly, I'm up even today, 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, I leave by 5. You know, when some people are still sleeping, I've already got half a day in.
And your day is?
It ends about 11 o'clock in the morning.
So, but what do you do during that time?
I'll get to the water first. I generally get enough wood for 2-3 days. There's dumpsters where there's construction going on, and I'll throw it over my partner, Bernard. We'll take it down and bring it to our house. Then I go out I call it can run. I go from 96th and Riverside, which is our entrance, all the way down to Midtown, walk around Midtown. I generally help supers, and they'd give me the cans, throw me some money. You know, I get things from my room, you know, quilts and whatnot. It was really nice.
Bob Kalinske lived underground in a Manhattan train tunnel for close to 8 years. Photographer Margaret Morton documents the tunnel's homeless community in her new book, The Tunnel. Our conversation will continue in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how to cook, keep warm, and keep clean while living in a subway tunnel. We continue our conversation with Bob Kalinske, who spent most of the past 8 years living underground with other homeless men in a tunnel under Manhattan's Upper West Side. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how the meaning of the word suburb has changed.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bob Kalinske, who spent most of the past 8 years living underground in a Manhattan train tunnel in a homeless community of about 50 people. The train line that first ran through the tunnel was discontinued in the mid-70s, which is when homeless people first started moving in. Amtrak laid new tracks for a passenger line in 91. Most of the homeless people have relocated with the help of homeless advocates and an obscure federal voucher program. Kalinske moved above ground last week. He's one of the people featured in the new book, The Tunnel, by photographer Margaret Morton, who has been documenting New York's homeless community since the late 80s. When we left off, Bob Kalinske was describing his living conditions in the tunnel.
You said you had a brick house down there?
Yeah, it was a workman's shack where they changed clothes and all that.
Oh,
it was
okay.
All brick.
So you didn't have to build it yourself?
No.
You just moved into a structure.
I just had to insulate the windows and whatnot, so I could walk in there in a T-shirt, and it could be 10 degrees above zero.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, describe what your living space was like in the tunnel.
Well, I don't know, 40 foot by 60. I had wall-to-wall carpeting, queen-size bed, table chairs, lamps, pictures on the wall, all painted. I insulated it. I mean, it was mine. I mean, I put a lot of effort and a lot of work into that.
Where did that all come from?
People throw stuff out. I mean, you'd be surprised in New York what people throw out. I've gotten VCRs, even though I don't have any electricity, TV sets, furniture, clothing. You know, this is a land of opportunity.
Did you have four walls in your
house? I had four walls, see, everything. You know, I had a lock on my door.
You had a lock on your door?
Yeah.
Huh.
We didn't know. See, one thing was there was nobody allowed in anybody else's room. You know, that was, there were certain rules you had to abide by. See, I could live by.
But say somebody broke the rules. I mean, who would enforce it?
They'd be
it?
Out. Bernard and I. Bernard and I were the longest people down there. Meaning that if somebody wanted to move in, there was an open space. Right now, we don't allow anybody because we're around the way moving out. I already moved. Bernard will move next week. We'd have a meeting between two of us. And we can get vibrations on somebody right off the bat if they would fit in. You know, you got to produce. You know, you don't lie in bed. Because you could lie in bed all day and get stagnated and not want to do anything. It was so easy. You know, but there's certain things you have to do. Either you're going to get the wood, or you're going to help with water, help get food or whatever, you know. But you're not going to stay in bed all day.
Well, say somebody wanted to move down there and you didn't want them.
Then they wouldn't move.
What would you do?
We tell them they couldn't move. Point blank. People in the tunnel know about Bernard and I from 72nd all the way. We're not about any nonsense. Back in 1989, a girl got raped, a girl by the name of Sheila, and Bernard and I helped apprehend the two guys. The book got 25 to life.
This was down on the tunnel,
down,
she
down
got
down the tunnel. It was documented. And the guys who did the thing tried to intimidate Bernard. One came by our space with a shotgun. One had a machete, and the other guy didn't have anything, but he didn't know what was happening because Bernard and I grabbed our axe handle, sat in the chairs in front of our room, and we were waiting for him. And they knew we were crazy, you know. You don't mess. Anywhere from 91st to 99th Street was our area. We've had Amtrak when they were putting the train tracks in. We used to leave stuff with us for security. Bridge and Tunnel would leave stuff with us for security because we were not about any nonsense. We're about surviving, not about, we never asked anybody for anything, never panhandled, never did, none of that stuff. We always went out and got what we had to get.
In the years that you lived in the Amtrak tunnel underground in New York City, how did you take care of your sanitary needs?
The restroom bathroom was open to us about 24 hours up by us, which was only like you could throw a rock to it. And there were SROs, we took showers. We had certain people we knew in the single democracy buildings who let us come up there and take a shower. So that was no problem.
Where would you get water?
There's a gas station or in the park. We take up, we had containers, 2.5 gallons each. We take up 4 or 5 containers for a couple of days at a time, you know.
How would you wash your bedding and your clothes?
We have a laundromat. It's on 91st and Broadway, once on 99th and Amsterdam. We have several places. We pick once every 2 weeks to do everything.
How'd you get money to do it?
Recycled cans, helping supers. I have supers I help.
These are apartment superintendents?
Yeah. They pay me for, like, taking up bags for them or helping take the recycling out. And the cans, you know. I make enough in cans. You know, we try to budget by Tuesday. If we're going to do laundry, like, on a Tuesday, we buy enough groceries to last Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or so we wouldn't have to do nothing the next day except the laundry, you know.
So you used to be a cook?
I've cooked all my life.
What kind of stuff did you cook in the tunnel?
No, Bernard, that was one thing we had a good arrangement. I just helped to supply the food. Bernard did the cooking because two cooks can't work in the kitchen. He was there before I would. I need a whole kitchen. He can cook in a little area.
He used to be a cook also.
Yeah, and he can cook in a smaller area. I need a whole big ovens and cook, you know, the whole bit.
So what would he make?
We had stews. We had everything you have. Our favorite was like Hillshire with sauerkraut, boiled potatoes, au gratin, or anything. You know, we cooked everything down there. We didn't spare no expense. When it came to eating, we made sure we ate one to two hot meals every day. Mine was mostly at dinner because I was up and out before everybody got up.
Any women living down there?
There was one. They don't have it because sometimes they cause a little too much confusion. That was Sheila who lived down there. Will passed away of AIDS. And Sheila's the girl that got raped. And mm-hmm. She lives now, I think, with her sister in Brooklyn.
Did she move out after the rape?
Shortly thereafter. Shortly thereafter.
Do you think that's why there weren't other women living down there?
No,
because
we just
of the
didn't
fear
want,
of rape?
No, we just didn't want... we had a couple try to live down there, but then the fellas wouldn't come out and do what they're supposed to do, and it was just like, you know... you have to be in an element like that, you have to know how to exist. And there's certain things you have to do every day or every second day if you're lucky enough to do it. But, you know, you can't get hung up with any other person or stagnated to where you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing because you're going to wake up, you're going to be hungry, you're not going to have any wood out there, you're going to have food but no wood or water to cook. You know, you have to make sure that's the number one priority down there is make sure you have your necessities.
So you're saying you didn't let women live down there because you thought they'd be a distraction.
Right. Right. And right now there aren't. In fact, there's only Bernard and one other person. He's leaving.
Right.
Hope Bernard should be leaving next week.
Were there women who wanted to live down there?
A couple did, you know. And we told the boyfriend that you can leave too, you know.
Oh, you didn't want couples down there?
No. No, we just, you know, it's just like there's too much, you know, focus taken off of, you know. But you can do that if you're living up top or if you, you know, have your apartment or if you're living in a community. But when you're living in that close of an area and everybody eats, everybody drinks water, everybody has their coffee and tea, then everybody has to supply it.
Now you said that down in the tunnel, people, you didn't allow people to have drugs or alcohol.
No, that was because that would stagnate them from doing what they had to do.
But that was your downfall, right? Drugs. That's how you ended
yeah.
up homeless in the first place. Once you got off of drugs, didn't you have any inclination to also get out of the tunnel and get back into, you know, get another job and have, you know, a more normal life, so to speak?
I had a heart attack about a year and a half ago. So about getting another job right away is like a little out of it. But I did take a little time out in 94 and went to a place called Peter's Place. And I was there for 19 months. But that was okay, but I was gained too much weight. I wasn't exercising, wasn't doing my walking and whatnot. So I left them back in November of 95. And we went back to the tunnel. But like I moved out, now I'll stay out for a while, you know.
Was there something that you liked about living in the tunnel?
Peace. It's like tranquility. When it gets dark, and we sit out, and Bernard and I will talk or listen to the radio, it's like we own the tunnel. It's like, you know, I told Bernard a while back, the only problem you have in life is what you ask for. I never had any company come into my room. I never had anybody knock on my door. I don't invite any chaos. You know, it was just like it's so quiet down there. You could hear a pin drop. In the morning, it's 5 o'clock, 4:30, you hear the birds up top. You know, I try to take as much pressure off myself now as I ever did in my life.
My guest is Bob Kalinske. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bob Kalinske. He spent most of the past 8 years living underground in a train tunnel in Manhattan. The homeless community there has been documented in a new book called The Tunnel by photographer Margaret Morton. Let me ask you, you know, I've taken a lot of Amtraks to New York. Maybe this wasn't, I guess this wasn't on the path that the Amtraks I've taken were on, but... Would passengers see you?
Oh yeah, they'd wave. One time, I don't know, something was wrong with the train. I wasn't down there. Bernard was there. It accidentally stopped in front of our place, and conductor got off and started looking underneath, and Bernard walked up and says hello, and the guy just jumped, you know. But we've had train stop, and I mean, like, yeah, it was unusual, but you know, it was good.
So 1 week ago, you moved out.
Yep.
And through a federal voucher?
Yeah.
You have a place now, and you're paying...
I pay $153 a month out of my pocket.
How are you getting the money?
I have... I just got my... See, I had SSI.
Uh-huh.
And then I had a... I let it go for a while, and I'm just getting it back again. I had a rectoactive checks coming now. Because I wasn't collecting anything for... By the time... since I went back in November, I didn't collect anything from SSI.
Right.
I just lived down there, you know. So now I have this coming back, and it's like I want to work, but I can't. Sometimes I have a hard time breathing.
Is that because of the tunnel or because of your heart attack?
No, because of my heart. I take four different kinds of medications.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's it like for you? You've been living above ground now for about a week.
Yeah.
What feels most different about it?
I don't know. It's that I'm by myself. You know, I'm basically a loner anyway. And down there, you know, it's just like you'd have Bernard around or you'd have somebody else around or you'd have to cater to people or if somebody wanted to talk to you, you'd have to get here. I don't have to do anything today that I don't want to do. You know, even though this morning I got up 2 o'clock, I was still out at 4 o'clock, even though I moved up top. I don't change my routine.
So you're still foraging for cans?
No, I don't do much can. I helped a couple supers because there's some stuff I needed to... They saved for me. One, mm-hmm. I'm going to see one tomorrow. It's got 4 boxes of beautiful books for me. Because I like to read now. So, you know, it's little things that they help you with. Hey, I don't mind doing it. It gives me something to do. It gets me out for a little while. You know, I can exercise. It's like exercise.
Does it feel good to be living above ground?
Yeah.
Does it feel like a victory for you?
Not a victory. It just feels good. It's just like I went on, one of my supers gave me a TV set last Friday. And it's just like I got a little thing, doing a little shopping, you know, to fix up my place. And it's just like, yeah, it's great. It was worth it. Being down there was a learning experience for me, by the way, because I appreciate today what the higher power gives me. I don't think about tomorrow. I don't think about yesterday. I concentrate on today, you know. He gives me what I need. He doesn't give me what I want, but he'll give me what I need. And he hasn't failed me since I put down the drugs.
Do you miss anything about the tunnel?
Tranquility. Well, I have tranquility in my room because I just put, as of today, I have no telephone calls are allowed up to my room. I think it's just the peace, you know, like I say, the darkness, sitting out by the grill at the end of the day, having, Bernard drinks tea, I drink coffee, have our last coffee. It's the peace. You know, it's you can grow, you know, grow being down there.
Now, you've had a long relationship with Bernard. I mean, you've been friends since you moved into the tunnel in 1988.
Oh, we have, yes, but we have our arguments. I mean, you could hear us all the way from 91st to 72nd, but we don't go to, you know, because you have to, you know, ventilate. We've never went to bed with any hard feelings, and he's the only one who could keep up with me and him both going out and doing what we had to do.
Were you going to miss him? I mean, he probably won't be living near
no,
you.
No, well, he's going to move uptown, but we'll be seeing each other.
You will?
Yeah. Yo, that's definite.
My guest is Bob Kalinske, and he spent from 1988 till about a week ago living underground in an Amtrak tunnel in New York City, and the tunnel is being evacuated, and he just moved above ground about a week ago. He's one of the people who Margaret Morton writes about in her new book, The Tunnel, which is also a photographic study of life in the tunnel. It's a part of a larger project that she's working on documenting homeless communities around New York City. So, Margaret, what's happening in the tunnel right now as, you know, in this transition period?
Well, it's really been a long, hard road getting everyone's documentation and trying to keep everything moving along. And finally, with Bob moving out last Friday, it's become really exciting to have people moving into apartments and really finding a place to live. And It's different. Every time I go down to the tunnel, I feel like it might be the last time. And I feel, after 5 years, happiness for the people that are moving out, but also some regret that I won't be going there anymore. I would agree with what Bob said, that it's really wonderful to just sit around the fire and Bernard will cook a wonderful meal and we'll just kind of sit there with our feet up on the grill, and it is incredibly quiet and dark. And I've come to really love the place, and it's become certainly part of my life over the past 5 years. And so I think I'm feeling like everyone else that lives in the tunnel, in a sense that I'm feeling happy and yet a little bit of sadness too.
Bob, what does it mean to you to have the book The Tunnel published that, you know, in a way documents your life and the lives of other people who lived in the tunnel?
It's great. I really have to give Margaret credit. I mean, she's come down there in 5 degree above zero weather, bundled up like a little Eskimo, just because it was a nice sunny day and the light was come through. Oh, this would be great light. Or she'd come down in 90 degree weather. She put a lot of effort into this book. You know, she became a real good friend.
Did you think she was for real at first?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I've seen many a photographer, many a camera crew. She was for real. Anybody who come down there like that at 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, like I say, 10 degrees above zero, and you know, really wanted to go, you know, take these pictures. Hey, we had to go for it. First thing we do is make her a cup of tea because she liked tea.
Margaret, did you start to feel differently traveling the New York City subways after you started visiting the homeless people in the tunnel?
I'm always looking out the windows of the subways. I'm always curious now what's taking place in a tunnel, and I'm surprised at how many times I do see signs of life or people or areas where people have been living as I look through the windows of the trains.
Photographer Margaret Morton, her new book is called The Tunnel. Bob Kalinske lived in the tunnel for close to 8 years. He moved out last week. Coming up, how the meaning of the suburbs has changed. This is Fresh Air. The recent celebration of John Keats's 200th birthday set linguist Jeff Nunberg to thinking about a lesser-known aspect of Keats' life. Jeff says Keats was not simply one of the great romantic poets, but one of the first suburbanites as well.
If you're looking for a trenchant history of the post-war American city, you could do worse than Barry Levinson's semi-autobiographical movie Avalon, about a boy growing up in the Baltimore area in the early 50s. In an early scene of the movie, the boy watches as his salesman father is mugged and stabbed in a downtown neighborhood. Shortly after that, we see the boy coming out of his family's row house to find a moving truck parked out front.
What does it mean?
What?
What does it mean, the suburbs?
It's just a nicer place to live.
That's what it means? A nicer place?
Yeah, it's nicer. It's got lawns and big trees.
For most Americans of that period, the word suburbs had a spanking new feel about it. It seemed to come into the American lexicon around the same time as words like crabgrass, barbecue, and carpool. As it happens, that's off by about 700 years. The word suburb actually goes back to the late Middle Ages, when it referred to the areas outside the city walls where people relegated a host of illicit and noxious activities, the tanneries and slaughterhouses, the gambling dens and bordellos. The phrase suburb sinner had a long life as a euphemism for prostitute. That's what Shakespeare was alluding to in Julius Caesar when he had Portia say to Brutus, "Dwell I but in the suburbs of your good pleasure. If it be no more, Portia is Brutus's harlot, not his wife." The suburb didn't start to become genteel until around the turn of the 19th century, when upwardly mobile Londoners began to take houses in the semi-rural districts just outside the city center. One of the first of these new suburbanites was John Keats, the son of a London livery stable keeper. In 1817, Keats moved with his friend Leigh Hunt to a cottage in the then suburban neighborhood of Hampstead, where they could go for long walks in the nearby countryside and return home to see the city spread out before them. To an aristocrat like Byron, the neighborhood seemed to symbolize all of the lower middle class vulgarity and pretension of Keats and Hunt's poetry. He dubbed the two the suburban school and likened them to clerks who put on their best clothes for a Sunday stroll in the countryside. In one way or another, the suburbs have come in for this kind of snobbish disdain ever since. To American artists and intellectuals of the 1950s and 60s, they were expanses of complacency and bland uniformity. Lewis Mumford described the Long Island development of Levittown as a treeless communal waste inhabited by people of the same class, the same income, the same age group, witnessing the same television performances, eating the same tasteless prefabricated foods from the same freezers, conforming in every outward and inward respect to the same common mold. It was a picture that was reinforced by movies like The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit and Martin Ritt's No Down Payment, and above all, in Malvina Reynolds' song Little Boxes, which became the anthem of anti-suburban condescension. Here's Pete Seeger's version of that song.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This was all unfair, and critics like Reynolds and Mumford never said exactly what the people in those houses were supposed to have done with their lives instead. Stayed in their walk-ups and become folk singers, I guess. Still, until recently, most people felt a certain defensiveness about coming from the burbs. Now, though, the very word suburb seems to be receding from the consciousness of the people who live in these places. Maybe you have to live on the West Coast to appreciate the effect fully. My friend Dana teaches in the architecture department at UCLA and begins every course by asking the students, how many of you grew up in the country? Maybe two hands go up. How many grew up in the city? Another two or three hands. How many grew up in the suburbs? No hands at all. Look, she says to the kids who haven't responded, did you live in a detached home? Did it have a lawn, a garage? Did you go shopping at a mall? Yeah, sure, they say. Well then, what would you call it? And they answer, oh, well, you know, it's just a place. The fact is that when you talk to young people in California localities like Thousand Oaks or Torrance or Dublin, they really have no consciousness of living in suburbs. And it's getting more like that in other parts of the country as well. One reason, I suppose, is that these places have become so self-sufficient that they no longer identify themselves in relation to a city. They have their own industrial parks and offices, their own shopping malls, their own art centers, universities, sports stadiums. If they think of the city at all, it's just as another mall a couple of freeway exits away. And in part, it has to do with a certain loss of racial memory, in the literal sense of the term, a forgetting of the urban flight that drove people to these places a couple of generations ago. It's as if they felt they have nothing to apologize for anymore. Urban planners and theorists have been trying to move away from the word suburbs, too. They prefer to talk about edge cities or urban villates or the metropolitan fringe. The Harvard urbanist Peter Rowe talks about the American middle landscape, an amorphous territory shaped by highways, detached houses, low-rise buildings, and shopping centers. Still, there's one group that hasn't forgotten the word suburb, the people who were left behind in that first flight from the cities after the war. You still hear the word in rap songs, as in these lines from Ice Cube's album America's Most Wanted, where he uses it to refer to the places where middle-class whites live.
Word, but who the hell is her? It's time.
Leaving aside Ice Cube's boisterousness here, there's an unmistakable irony in this use of suburbs. The fact is that the neighborhoods that the gangster rappers come from, like Compton and South Central L.A., have detached houses and lawns and trees, just like the places that the characters in Avalon moved to after the war. But for a lot of people now, the suburbs become a social space, not a geographical one. There's still a line between the hood and the burbs, but it isn't visible from a distance anymore, the way it was for Keats.
Jeff Numberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. We have a poem for you by Robin Becker from her new book, All American Girl. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, who is also a poet, says about this book, unsparing and self-knowing, Robin Becker uses irony as if it were a form of directness. These painful, often devastating poems contend with crushing loss, the convolutions of sexuality and family politics, the struggle to accept the self. Here's Robin Becker reading her poem, The Roast Chicken.
The Roast Chicken. When I set the roast chicken in the center of the table and sat down alone to eat, I understood the meaning of my life. That morning, when I squirted the lousy Cambridge water into the coffee pot, I knew why my sister took her life. The first night, I ate the roast chicken in honor of couples, in honor of the labor and elegance of compromise. The second night, I ate the roast chicken weeping with self-pity, because I had no partner to designate on my health plan form, should I become incapacitated, my life sustained solely by machines. The third night I picked at the chicken and considered how my life has been a flight from family and how I've arrived at middle age without one. Who will remember with me the old North Broad Street train station? Who will bike with me to the drugstore in Mount Airy for my sister's medication? Who will know the hatred I harbored for my father, who could not tolerate noise? And who will love me now that I have become him, a person who cannot tolerate noise? Who will ask me about the Saturdays I wandered around Chestnut Hill my senior year in high school, with a little money in my pocket, looking at earrings and developing expensive taste? Now I watch my neighbors kneeling in the early November cold to plant their spring bulbs. Their faith amazes me, for today I understand that by such deeds human goodness is recognized. All week, the brick streets of Cambridge have been saying goodbye, quietly hushed by leaves, like a lover who knows it's over and speaks kindly, finally, in a cafe before she disappears. And you're left knowing that she was your best chance, though she would say your best chances are the ones you take.
Robin Becker's new collection of poems, All American Girl, is published by University of Pittsburgh Press. She's currently a fellow at the Bunting Institute of Radcliffe College. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting the 3-CD box set People Get Ready, The Curtis Mayfield Story, highlighting work with the Impressions and as a solo artist. This is NPR, National Public Radio.